So I want to talk about some of the cases that have been seen, particularly with COVID, to give a little bit of a flavor to how this is done. Nair, this is a list that you discussed in the lecture that we did together. Can you comment on your clinical experiences, Nair?
Well, I think Leora's point about safety, particularly as there's some surging in states, is really important, because these patients, our patients with lung cancer, do poorly, and there are 6 out of 14 patients that in our group that died from COVID, and some of them were. Most of them were actually not even, the first one was on observation, and on no treatment. Then the second one was on osimertinib. I think that, continuing to maintain that sort of vigilance is really important. And it can get a little bit tricky to figure out what's going on with the patient. This patient was on an EGFR inhibitor trial, with an exon 20 insertion, and he had disease at the right base there, that we were following related to his cancer, and then he had a scan that came up on the right, which showed kind of evolution of changes in that right base, which I think at first blush we thought could be related to his disease progression, but we actually tested him and he was COVID 19 positive at that visit, and so we continued him on protocol therapy, and then a subsequent scan actually showed that area had sort of resolved, and he was back to his baseline scan. So just speaking to, making treatment decisions, when you have changes like this, it makes it harder.
So do you think that was COVID there that localized, sort of, or at least imaging wise localized?
I assume so. I mean, I think.
And did
so.
He have a fever or a shortness of breath?
I mean, he always had a cough related to his cancer, so it was a little bit hard to say. I mean, he didn't have any fever. So,
how about this patient?
Yeah, so this one was sort of an unfortunate patient who, in the left chest X-ray, you can see is a large right lower lobe mass, right upper lobe mass, and then he underwent chemotherapy and radiation therapy for stage 3B squamous cell carcinoma. And then he was into about his third durvalumab consolidation treatment, and he developed these extensive bilateral pulmonary infiltrates, and did end up dying of pulmonary insufficiency. So, and he was COVID positive. So the question is this COVID? Is this immunotherapy? Is this, how much of this was radiation related? It was a little bit hard for us to put together, but we, certainly treated him with everything we had, but he did expire.
Did he spend time in the ICU? Was he intubated?
He was, yeah.
Leora, in your data, a lot of the initial data was coming out of Italy where they were really overwhelmed. When you look more in the U.S., Leora, what kind of access to ICUs do you see cancer patients having? Are they getting bumped out in areas where there's a lot of COVID?
A little bit hard to know. The CCC19 showed that the percentage of patients who went to ICU, so that was primarily U.S., only 7% of those patients were in Spain, showed that the ICU admission rate was 13%. What we don't know is, were there more patients who met ICU criteria who were not admitted, whereas in Terravolt, we've collected that data of, was ICU indicated, and if it wasn't, why were they not admitted? Some of the data from Terravolt we're looking at now, looking at more of a U.S. population. The only data that we have right now is the Memorial data that was 24%, but there is a bias that we saw with the lung cancer patients, even with a few U.S. centers saying that ICU was not indicated because of stage 4 disease. What was striking with the Terravolt data as well is 75% of those patients had had no therapy or on first-line therapy, and in a disease where we've made such an impact on survival, not having therapy or even being on first-line therapy, which we know can have a good impact on our patients' overall survival. It's really sad to know that such a high percentage of those patients died so early.
So, Lisha, in the presentation you put together, you went through a bunch of issues related to the what you see as the effect on patients and patient care, and brought up a lot of really thoughtful points. I'd like to get the feedback from the other two faculty members on. So could you kind of go through that?
Sure. I was just reflecting because in Boston, we're a little bit about 6 weeks past our peak. So we're really starting to see how this has affected our patients going through this time period. We talked before about we tried to continue on with treatments as much as we could, but Nair mentioned this too. Many patients opted to delay treatments, office visits, scan biopsies, even if the health system was offering it to them because they were scared to come into the city, scared to, you know, be around other people. And I think that I'm seeing in clinic now some patients with fairly advanced symptomatic presentations that, you know, we probably could have got to them earlier if they were more willing to come in. And then I think we've all seen that therapeutic clinical trials, collection of research samples that go along with trials and lung cancer screening have really been scaled down. You know, my experience, at least with trials, was that sponsors became very flexible and were quite reasonable, I thought, in letting us cut out some procedures related to research and keep the treatment, the key portion, going. But certainly accrual to new studies is down for many reasons, including resources at the hospital and patients willing to travel to tertiary centers to get on scans, to get on studies.
Just to pick up on that for a second, Leora, you know, one of the issues is, you know, with the use of telemedicine, whether or not, you know, in the future, maybe we could see more trial accrual if we used more telemedicine. A lot of patients don't want to go to tertiary centers. Can you do informed consents through telemedicine? Can you execute the process with a local doc? Where do you see that heading, Leora?
I really hope in a positive direction. I think that COVID has shown us that there are a lot of tests and patients on trials that do not need to, you know, that 3-week blood test you have to come in just for your labs that you have to do at a lab that's certified per the trial. During COVID, we've done those labs locally and the patients are still fine. So I'm hoping that that improves. Studies have allowed patients to get consents done via telehealth. And I hope telehealth comes and stays because it's such a good thing for the patients. And hopefully it will improve in accrual. The problem will be on those, obviously, those trials where the patient needs IV therapy that needs to be administered somewhere. Maybe they have to come, but I'm really hoping that telehealth helps catapult us there. You know, we had similar issues with delayed biopsies or foregoing biopsies. We had patients who were eligible for studies, but they needed a fresh biopsy. And I, as a physician, said, you know what, it's not worth the risk of going into our main hospital when, because, you know, we do have COVID patients here. It's just not a lot. Let's keep you in the part of the clinic where the COVID patients are not. Let's forget about the study and give you standard of care. But hopefully this will also make regulatory agencies and companies realize that this is a good thing for patients. Keep them at home, decrease these unnecessary visits and unnecessary tests.
And, you know, you're thinking back to Nair's patient with the exon 20, you know, a lot of times the trial is the best therapy. We know that, you know, best. That's what I want to be getting, you know, in a lot of these situations. Just going back to the MGH situation, back to the slides again, Lisha, you commented about the issue of the fact that, you know, visitors are not allowed in the hospital, not allowed to the clinic, the effect on palliative care, the effect on hospice, the effect on relationships with patients. Any comments, Lisha?
Yeah, one of my palliative care colleagues called COVID-19 the loneliest disease, and it really was patients, especially who were hospitalized and known COVID positive. We were pretty strict about visitors, and one of the hard things about a large number of our patients that were hospitalized is they also didn't speak English. The majority of them spoke Spanish, and we were able to implement some special Spanish language physician teams that would be on the floor, even if they weren't the primary team taking care of the patient. They would act as a translator, but a medically knowledgeable translator, and really helped some of these cultural, you know, we had these horrible, sad situations where there'd be five or six members of one extended family all in the hospital on different floors, some of whom were gravely ill or passed away, and trying to help these families navigate this tragedy requires a lot of creative skills.
So Nair was talking about the challenges of diagnosis, and you also brought this up. You were also telling me you felt like the imaging people at MGH were getting really good at diagnosing COVID, and yet I hear from a lot of other people that a lot of times people think it's COVID and it's tumor or whatever. And any comments on these images, Leisha?
Yeah, I think, you know, as with cancer assessments too, you know, radiology comfort with different things can certainly vary from radiologist to radiologist. As an oncologist, I love radiology. I love to go to the film room. My colleagues make fun of me for how much I love radiology. And so I'm in awe of our MGH radiologists. And I had several experiences where I felt that they really helped the clinical care by bringing COVID into the differential. These are two such cases. So the case on the right is a 47-year-old female with no cancer history, just a healthy young woman who came into our emergency room with cough and shortness of breath and had this chest CT. The overnight radiologist, who was not thoracic specialized, said, oh no, this looks like lung cancer. And that's why I was called first thing in the morning for a consult, a new lung cancer in a 47-year-old woman. When I looked at the scan with the thoracic specialized radiologist, they said, this doesn't look like cancer. This looks like COVID. And she's got a cough and shortness of breath. And sure enough, she was positive for COVID.
What was it that made them think it was COVID? What specifically?
So, you know, I think we're still learning about the patterns that COVID can take on radiographically, but one of the first described kind of classic appearances was, it was just like this scan, kind of a rounded, almost looks like rounded atelectasis or, you know, rounded pneumonia kind of appearance, tends to be in the posterior portions of the lungs along the periphery. So really a textbook appearance, according to them, of what COVID looks like in this 47-year-old woman.
How about the 75-year-old woman?
There? Yeah, so the 75-year-old woman is a patient of mine with lung cancer who was diagnosed just at the beginning of 2020 with a right upper lobe lung cancer that was causing a lot of obstruction. And so she'd had cough from the day I met her and was in the middle of chemotherapy and getting sicker in March of this year. And I thought, just based on looking at her in the clinic, that her cancer was probably progressing. And so we got restaging scans, and her cancer was relatively stable, which is above the slice I'm showing you here. But she had all these new peripheral rounded ground glass opacities that the radiologist thought looked like COVID, and we tested her and she was positive as well. So
so what treatment was she on at that point, and what'd you do about her treatment?
She was on carboplatin and pemetrexed, and we held her treatment. She was quite ill, so you know, she wasn't, even if she'd been negative for COVID, we probably would have held her chemotherapy. She did not need to go into the hospital. I mean, she was in her 70s, so I really thought, unfortunately, the cards were stacked against her. She managed to survive. She's actually doing much better now. But she was ill at home with fevers, cough. We had to get her oxygen at home, in bed, essentially, for about 6 or 7 weeks.
So, Nair, you know, one of the things that came out when we did our program on CLL, and we had actually Anthony Matto from Memorial across the way from you, was talking about the challenge of seeing patients that look like they have COVID but test negative. And you know, these people generally, it sounds like they're getting managed as if they have COVID, I think COVID presumed, so to speak. Have you seen that phenomena where, Nair, where it looked like the patient had COVID and yet tested negative?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's not an uncommon problem for, you know, within our cancer population as well as non-cancer. I mean, I think, remember these assays were set up, you know, very quickly and, you know, with patients who were gravely ill And so, you know, the threshold that they use is, you know, could be too high. And so I think that we've definitely had patients who, you know, who, and staff, you know, who I think will know more as we get more and more information on antibody results on people and that may have tested negative but have antibodies now.
So in a second, I would like to also, Lisha, to continue elaborating on some of the impacts she's seen in patient care. But just to go back to you, Leora, I know in our conversations, one of the things you've talked a lot about is the psychosocial impact of this situation, not only on the patients, but the families and the caregivers. Anything that you've seen that's been particularly helpful to try to assist patients sort of navigating their way through this?
Yeah, so I think it's been easier in the outpatient than the inpatient, you know, similar to what Lisha saw. In inpatient now, we allow one family member. Something that we've done a lot, I'm walking around with my iPad, which I never used to do, and we FaceTime a lot of patients. I created a new email just so not everyone has my phone number suddenly. But so if only one, for example, if a patient can only be there with their husband, but their children, they actually have to sit in the car if they've driven here with family members. The family members can't even stay in the lobby. So we'll FaceTime them and we'll bring them into the conversation. I also am spending a lot more time in the evening calling other family members just to kind of keep them up to date. So to let them know what I told their significant other. Because often people will come with two or three visitors and you need those extra set of ears, especially when things are going great. That's all you need, but you need those extra set of ears afterwards. We also have a survey that's live now with TerraVault looking at patients' perspective and what they've experienced with lung cancer so that we can sort of better understand what we need to offer our patients for support as the next wave continues, especially here in the U.S.
Are you aware of any data that looks at sort of what patients have access to? Because that's another issue, Leora. It's all well and good if somebody has a computer and they had to use Zoom and all, but lots of patients don't have computers. They don't have smartphones. What do we know about the ability of patients to access telemedicine?
It's a great question. I can only tell you anecdotally in the South, many of my patients have flip phones. They don't have smartphones. Many of my patients' telehealth visits have turned into phone visits because they can't figure out how to log into the MyHealth at Vanderbilt app and then connect to Zoom. Many of our patients, if I am seeing them on Zoom, it's because their children are available. So access is a huge issue. Here in the South, it just is a patient thing, especially lung cancer patients are a little bit older. I would imagine in some other parts of the U.S. where there's more lower income families, different socioeconomic status, that will continue to be an issue.
So before I go back to Leisha, I see an interesting question in the chat room, Nair, about the effect of immunotherapy as monotherapy compared to dual immunotherapy. I assume that's ipi-nivo. And of course, all you need to do to get a fight started amongst pulmonary oncologists is say the word ipi-nivo nowadays. But I love hearing about it because I thought it's fascinating. So Nair, first of all, immunologically, let's say single agent monotherapy versus ipi-nivo in terms of immune, you know, problems, immune effects, and where, if at all, would you like to use ipi-nivo nowadays, Nair, if at all?
So in terms of the first question, I mean, I don't think we really know. It hasn't really been extensively tested whether monoimmunotherapy or dual immunotherapy, you know, was going to influence COVID. I mean, there was an analysis that Sloan Kettering did in Cancer Discovery looking at the effects of immunotherapy on you know, in their population. It didn't seem to be deleterious. I mean, the second question in terms of, you know, where we use it, I think that the best data from my perspective is in the PD-L1 zero patients, you know, where we saw, you know, a high degree of activity and a good survival benefit in PD-L1 zero patients. So I think for patients where you may be wanting to spare chemotherapy, but they're PD-L1 zero, I think it seems to be a good option. It doesn't seem to me in the other PD-L1 subgroups to be clearly superior to pembrolizumab monotherapy.
Yeah, and that's where I'm hearing people talk a lot about is PD-L1 zero patients, although you can get the argument in terms of duration of response. So that data looks pretty interesting, but that will be for another time. So, Lisha, you had this slide here that kind of summarizes some of your thoughts about kind of what's been going on the last few months. I'd like you to maybe chat a little bit about that to close here.
Sure. I think one of the things that's really hit me recently is how much of an impact this has had on our patients, not merely in terms of cancer treatment, but so many other factors, especially mental health factors. In addition, the effect it's having on the teams, the physicians and other providers that are caring for these patients in a very different setting that used to be team focused and is now, you know, you're much more by yourself or over Zoom with patients. And I think the level of stress, anxiety, depression is high among both the patients and all the providers these days. And so it's a really hard time. But nevertheless, I'm hopeful that my colleagues here on the phone have been some of the leaders in the field as far as improving our understanding of what's going on with COVID. And I think that one thing that we really have to watch for in the future is the larger effects that this period of time has had on our field, both in terms of our patient outcomes as well as our research productivity. I mean, I think the ripple effect is going to go on for quite a few years.
So it kind of seems like hope and faith is kind of hard to come by nowadays, but we in oncology have always been able to meet that challenge and find reason for optimism. Thanks so much to the faculty for joining us today. Thanks you for attending. Be safe and stay well.